This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
Scientists admit first baby with three parents was lucky not to be a mutant baby with faulty DNA. Okay, that's probably something that as a parent I should have known in advance. By the way, your kid could be a lizard kid. I'm just saying. Billy Graham is under fire. How could Billy Graham be under fire? Nobody's seen Billy Graham in a while. His rules for marriage under fire. This is the Mike Pence argument that happened last week. Let's get into that, beginning right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
All right. The debate over Mike Pence and his personal policy of not eating dinner alone with a member of the opposite sex has created quite a stir in America because, you know, we don't have anything important going on, right? I mean, this is the most important thing we could argue about. Let's keep things into perspective. The thing we have to argue about is Mike Pence. Mike Pence is not the guy who created the policy. It was crafted back in the 1940s. And it's known as the Billy Graham Rule. Named after Billy Graham, the evangelist who followed the same standard in his own life and ministry. Graham is to say is said to have drafted the rule in 1948 as part of a four-pronged moral approach to ministry. It was important to uphold the highest standard of biblical morality and integrity, according to Billy Graham in 1948. The rules of the Billy Graham Rule in his book, Just As I Am. We all knew of evangelists who had fallen into immorality while separated from their families by travel. We pledged among ourselves to avoid any situation that would even have the appearance of compromise and suspicion. From that day on, I did not travel, meet, or eat alone with any woman other than my wife. Let's just start on that one. Why is that one so bad? Listen to this. Mm-hmm. What did he say? We all know of evangelists who had fallen into immorality while separated from their families by travel.
So trying to take a step to solve that problem.
Mm-hmm. Not only that, we pledged among ourselves to avoid any situation that would even have the appearance of compromise or suspicion. We all know that because of what happened in the 80s and 90s with, you know, Jim Baker and all of that stuff, that evangelists started to look like scumbags. All of them were dirt bags. Back in the 90s, it felt like every single guy who was a priest or a pastor was a dirt bag. Yeah,
the documentary Fletch really covered pretty well.
No, that's mm-hmm. not really a documentary. So what is he doing? Now he's saying this in 1948 when apparently they were having problems with it too. And he said, let's just avoid all appearance. Well, that's to restore the honor and the integrity of people of the cloth. Is there anything wrong with that?
I can tell you, obviously, the left has lots of problems with this.
Of course they do.
You can make an argument, right? I mean, his standard is actually tougher than the Pence standard because it was not meet or eat, right? Graham's standard was not even meet.
Meet or eat alone mm-hmm. with any woman other than my wife.
I mean, that's even more strict than what Pence was saying.
Snarky article about how insulting that is, an insulting view of men and a limiting role for women. We're either there to entice or domesticate. That's not the point.
It's the appearance.
It's avoid the appearance.
And also
avoid the temptation. Avoid any of those things.
And it's also to avoid avoid the situation that someone can say something happened in a meeting that didn't happen.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly an understandable thing to protect yourself from. We've seen, obviously many high profile people have been in situations where they've been accused of things, which they say I mean, who knows what the truth is, but they say they didn't do. Certainly some of those stories are true.
Let's take it this way. Did Roger Ailes go after these women at Fox?
I mean, I don't know.
We don't know. It seems.
No. Seems what?
We don't know.
Yeah, we don't know.
There's a lot of people accusing him of doing that, and the company paid out millions and millions of dollars.
Okay. So now next level. Is there a possibility that he did some of these and he didn't do others?
Yes. Sure, okay. Of course.
Mm-hmm. So if he had this standard, would that have happened?
No, because he wouldn't have been alone with him.
Right? I mean, it could have happened, but there would have been less evidence. It would have been less people probably would have believed it. We have no idea. Like, I have no personal knowledge of him ever having a personal meeting with one of these women.
Nope.
So they could obviously say that happened anyway. But you're right. Like, if he was known for having a lot of these private meetings, it would be more believable in the company that these things occurred.
Right.
Sure. I think, like, there's a line there. First of all, with the idea of doing it for appearance sake, which is, you know, it's not, that's on you. If you have you have an inaccurate belief of what's happening in my life and you decide to judge it that way, that's not on me. Now, I have to deal with the consequences if everyone believes some lie, right? But it's not my responsibility to craft what your opinion is of me. It is not, that is on you. If you decide to believe things that aren't true for whatever reason, because you think I'm having dinner with somebody, that's really not my fault. So I can understand that being, an argument. And I'm from the left side, and I make this as a little bit of a devil's advocate point. The left is saying, look, we all know, and this is true, that if you're a guy and you get a chance to be, alone with a boss and make your case, you have a good chance, a chance of improving. Also, by the way, blowing your career up. Sometimes, those meetings happen too, where you have this nice big meeting and you come up with this great idea and they're like, that's the dumbest idea in the world. But that moment is important, especially as you're coming up in a company. If you're able to impress a boss in a one-on-one situation, that could be big for your career. Sure. And what women are arguing is, wait a minute, guys can do that with you, but I can't.
You don't have to go to dinner to do that. You can do that at the office.
Although that can't happen. Billy Graham's rule, you wouldn't be able to do it at the office.
Yeah.
But Pence's rule, he did just say it was dinner. However, I mean, business gets done in this country over dinner and drinks all the time. That's very common. So if the guy can go out with you, now it's one thing if you say I'm never meeting with anyone one on one, but if you say I'm going to meet with guys one on one and I'm not going to meet with women one on one.
No, I think that's wrong.
They can say that. I mean, that's
I think you can't say as a boss, hey, you know what, Bill, we've got some work to do. Let's just go grab a beer. Let's do this after dinner. And not do that with women. I don't think, I think that sets an unfair balance because there is bonding. You know, hey, you know what, let's just go play a round of golf. Just the two of us, let's go play a round of golf. If you won't play golf with everybody, then you shouldn't play golf with anyone.
Interesting. I don't think that's the Pence standard, or most people that defended the Pence standard were arguing. Because
I don't think that's. I can see how that is perceived as unfair. Look, you're going to go out and bond with somebody, and you're not giving me the chance to bond with you. And when it comes to executive level positions, it really is about who you can bond with and who you can trust. Now, I don't need to play a round of golf. I don't need to go have a private dinner with somebody. I mean, is there a guy that you know of that has hired more women as executives than me?
No, many. And you obviously have met with all of them at one time or another. You have to have especially when you're hiring someone to a big position that you trust, you want to have a one-on-one conversation,
but
get to know them.
I would never travel, for instance, my assistant, Michelle. I wouldn't travel alone with Michelle, just the two of us going out for, hey, I got to go to San Francisco, Michelle, just the two of us.
Nor would you invite a woman out to dinner, just the two of you? Hey, I can't imagine that. Would you do that?
No, because I don't do that with anybody anyway, because my wife is.
But again, you also are.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with taking your wife on this trip with you, with another woman and giving her a promotion then.
But like what you're saying to the woman is that we have to have a chaperone. I can't have a moment with you, like where you know, there are moments in one-on-one where, yes, there are moments where one-on-one also creates sex, which is obviously the point here. However, there are a lot of moments where one-on-one might create a real trust in a business relationship. And the fact that you have somebody else at the dinner.
You can do that at the office. You can always do that at the office. You don't have to do
that at
dinner.
So Pat and I.
I would never do it.
I started watching a movie. We have Mark Duplass on today, who is great. Yeah. He's an independent filmmaker, but he also.
You probably know him from The League, if you've ever watched The League on FX. Okay. He's like the main character of that show.
All right. So he's brilliant. He did a movie called Blue Jay. Now, he's just done a three-movie deal with Netflix where I don't even think they asked him for the movies. They're just like, here's money. Go make three movies. It was really brilliant. Mm-hmm. Watch his movie Blue Jay. Started watching it last night. And it is brilliant, really brilliant. And it's about two people that were teenage, you know, love story. And have just loved each other. They're in their 40s now, and they still love each other. But hadn't seen each other for 25 years. And there is some tension between them. Something happened, and that's what broke them up. And so it chronicles their 24 hours together of meeting again. And the whole time, you're thinking, okay, all right, she's married, he's not. And you're like, okay, this isn't good. You want to come back to the house? No, you're thinking, no, don't do that. And she is really, really strong. She's like, he tries to kiss her and she says no, blah, blah, blah. And it's really, but at the end, because there is something between them, they do start to fool around. Now she stops, but they do start to fool around. Who couldn't see that coming? Now I'm not saying that every man and woman have that attraction to each other.
Right.
I mean,
right, obviously.
Ladies, I know.
With you, they do.
With obviously, me, they do. It's unquestioned.
There's so many different reasons.
The abs.
Even if they don't see your face, they're going to see the abs.
You can see my abs through my shirt, and I don't mean to.
No, you don't mean to do
it's
that.
Just that they're so big, they're pushing out and kind of stretching the buttons.
Yeah,
anyway.
It's weird. I didn't know that was an ab, but
yeah.
It's one ab.
Okay. I have one
giant ab. That's interesting.
But and a belly button in the middle of it. But so you know, not everybody has that, but that is part of life. That there is the attraction,
of course,
especially when you're going down the same path, you're on the same kind of career course, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That stuff does happen.
And you should obviously be careful with that, right?
Yes.
I mean, you know, especially with a person in that area. But I mean, like having dinner with some business associate one-on-one, you know, talking about an important business deal, I mean, you guys are not doing it. And I think the criticism of this idea is ridiculous, right? I mean, like, it's a typical stupid blown up in the media left wing story. So I'm not giving it any credence. But like, if you guys went out with a female executive for dinner, nothing's going to happen because you don't want it to happen. It's about you making the choice and her making the choice.
Yeah, she's
whoever
vomiting.
She is. Right, she's disgusted,
vomiting.
So she's out.
Yeah, she's
but even
out.
If you wanted to be in, you would still stop yourself
right.
Because that's what your gig is.
Right.
You take your marriage
if somehow
seriously.
Or another. She fell and her eyes started to see something that looked appetizing.
Yes.
In me, she mm-hmm. still would be out.
Right,
but
that's on you.
Right,
right. Like,
but
and
here's
so
the thing: the appearance.
But that's on me. The appearance.
No,
you're doing
it's not.
It for
it's
other
on
eyes.
Society.
You're doing
there's nothing
it. Now,
wrong
you as
it.
A celebrity, I understand that, right? Because people might take pictures of you. Who's this person Glenn Beck's with? I get that at some level.
No, but
for
wait,
the average
wait.
Person, I don't think.
I take this back to because this is not just about women. I take this back to drinks. I'm an alcoholic. I never go to a cocktail party and ask for a glass of water. I ask for a bottle of water. Mm-hmm. If they don't have a bottle of water, I won't have water. I do not want a glass with ice in it and clear liquid. I want a bottle of water. Now, what's the problem with that?
There's no problem with it. However, the two things. A, you are a celebrity. And if someone saw you with a clear glass of liquid, they might accuse you and probably would. You'd be
difference
on Breitbart
between,
in about 10 minutes.
Hang on. Difference
oh,
between
heartbeat.
Difference between. Tell me the difference between a celebrity where somebody's going to take a picture of me and put it out there and blah, blah, blah. And me as just an average Joe.
Because nobody cares.
Oh, that's not true.
That's not,
been around gossipy people in church.
Sure.
You've never been around gossipy people in the office.
The ramifications are a completely different scale, right? I mean, like, you're a, you know, people...
But so is your life, is it a different scale? I mean, it's still your life.
Yes. However, what was it? A million retweets when someone saw you in a scarf? You woke Glenn Beck and all of a sudden you were like the number one trending thing on Twitter because you wore a stupid scarf one day or ascot, whatever the heck it was.
It wasn't an ascot.
I only say ascot because I know you hate it. But I mean, again, like, so there is a different scale there.
Does scale matter?
Ask Jeffy's house in this poor bathroom.
All right. When it comes to flushing, yes, it does.
The Glenn Beck Program.
The fusion of entertainment and enlightenment.
We are one. The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Sign up for the newsletter and get all the info you need to know at glennbeck.com.
Just a real quick personal note for all those, and thank you so much for praying for Tanya over the last couple of weeks. Tanya was diagnosed with trigeminal nerve disorder, and it has been excruciatingly painful. And to watch my wife like that for 2 weeks has just been horrid. And Friday, we were praying and just felt like that isn't it. There's more to it. And on Sunday, she said, I think I have to go to the dentist again. And the dentist had already. She goes into the dentist, and it is a dead root that was into her trigeminal nerve. And she had to have a root canal yesterday and fixed it.
Wow.
And I've never been so. I mean, she was on the phone, and she's like, I'm like, good for you. So it was really
a root canal had ever been cheered.
Never been happy to have somebody have a root canal. And so thank you for your prayers. And this too has passed. So
a couple tweets coming in on our conversation. Listening to you talk now, the issue is women could never have that rule. They wouldn't have jobs or promotions.
You can get a promotion without going to dinner with somebody.
You don't have to go to dinner to give somebody a promotion.
Right.
Does it have to be a dinner?
Right. And I just think that...
What if it's like a bed conversation? Do you have to come into my bed and we'll do it there? I mean, what the hell? What is that?
I mean, but a lot of... No, it does. Dinner meetings are very standard fare.
They are very standard.
I don't think it's that standard.
I think it is.
Do it in the office. Big deal. The marriage is more important than the job. And if you don't like that, you know, tough.
Yeah, but here's the thing. You should have a consistent rule. I mean, it's 2017. You're going out with you very likely could go out to dinner with a gay man. Is that okay? What about a straight man? What about a man who's still questioning? Is that okay? Why not just no dinner alone with anyone? That's the way it should be.
Mm-hmm. We should probably all consider no dinner at all. Honestly,
for a long time.
Yeah, about 6 months.
For about 40 pounds.
Uh-huh. The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Hello and welcome to the program. So glad that you are here today. There is something that is a fascinating character trait of Pat that I just figured out, and I think we've all come to this conclusion, that Pat, if he hears one little fact about something that is really usually not that interesting, he will go down a rabbit hole.
Oh, yeah.
And he'll just continue to dig and dig and dig.
It's actually funny and enjoying.
Yeah, yeah. He did this with Foreigner, and it doesn't really ever merit any fruit. There's never
well,
something.
I don't know. I disagree with this analysis. I find it interesting because what you get,
it bears really good fruit.
Yeah.
Fascinating facts.
Well, nothing ever really changes. Like, Foreigner is still not in the Rock and Roll.
No, he hasn't changed the world necessarily for these moments, but it does improve my life a little bit, because what happens is a name that maybe Pat hasn't thought about in a while or never heard of, gets into the Pat Gray lexicon. And then he will spend every free moment for about a week.
Who is the singer?
The most recent example of this is Ed Sheeran, which is Pat had never heard of as about 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And we brought him up in a random conversation. Mm-hmm. And then
in the makeup room.
Yeah, in the makeup room.
Right before the show.
Which is where that's a good place to come up. That's where boys talk.
Right. Getting makeup done.
And by the way, we never allow a woman in the makeup room.
Not alone.
So
I don't know what they have business doing in the makeup room in the first place.
Thank you.
They've showered in there.
They're applying
anyway,
makeup.
But go ahead.
So we brought up Ed Sheeran. If you don't know who he is, he's a big star, a huge star. Makes something like $60 million a year. He's like number 30 or 40 on the Forbes celebrity list. Mm-hmm. Huge amount of money. Or maybe it's even higher than that.
Yeah, that's what started the story, because Ed was saying that he made all this money and he wasn't giving his friends money.
Oh, yeah, the friends were bugging him for money. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, who's Ed Sheeran? Why does he have money?
So, but what happens, the fruit of this is every day for about a week, you realize that Pat has spent at least an hour on the internet researching this person, and he comes in with, this is all he's thinking about. He goes on one-track mind mode. And every day he comes in with these little nuggets of information that are really interesting about the person.
But it changes his lexicon.
It changes
his lexicon.
Like, did you know that Ed Sheeran slept with many people in Taylor Swift's squad?
Legitimately.
I didn't know that. I didn't know she had a squad.
Right.
Oh, yeah, she does.
Apparently
not
Taylor herself, but a lot of the squad he's been with.
Yeah. Wow.
Now, he got with him.
And I mean this seriously. That was like the first sentence Pat said to me one day. Was what the sentence you just heard.
Right.
Out of Pat Gray's mouth, talking about Taylor Swift's squad with the word squad utilized.
And then I realized, apparently squad is a thing now, right?
Right.
It used to be posse.
Right.
Now it's squad.
Right.
So that is...
So you're still learning.
I'm still learning.
That's great.
Yeah. It is really continuing education.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is. It's Pat Gray's continuing education, because it's always interesting.
The latest thing is, we just found this Ty Cobb PragerU discussion about Ty Cobb not being who you think he is.
Now, because I'm a big baseball fan. Mm-hmm. I know.
Yeah, me too.
We're all sports fans.
And what have you always heard about Ty Cobb? Do you know about Ty Cobb at all?
No, I just know he's a bad guy. That's all anybody knows about him.
Racist.
Great baseball player. Racist.
Dirty player.
Killed a guy. Never paid for it. Spiked people when he slid into second base as often as he could. You know, that kind of thing. Well, listen to this.
He was Major League Baseball's first superstar, the first man ever inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, and he still has the game's highest career batting average, .366, almost 90 years after he retired.
Wow.
His name is Ty Cobb. Yet despite his historic achievements, he is often remembered for being the worst racist and the dirtiest player ever to take the field. If you know baseball, you've heard the stories. Ty Cobb would pistol whip black men he passed on the street. He once stabbed to death a black waiter in Cleveland just because the young man was acting uppity.
Mm.
On the field, he was said to sharpen his spikes to cut up rival infielders. Yeah. He supposedly had no friends. In the movie Field of Dreams, Shoeless Joe Jackson says that Cobb wasn't invited to the ghostly cornfield reunion because, quote, no one liked the son of a bitch. A lifelong baseball fan, I believe these stories when I set out to write the first authoritative biography of Cobb in 20 years. I've been hearing them all my life. And like a lot of people, I took the repetition as evidence.
Wow.
But to my astonishment, as I delved into the source material, newspapers, census reports, and personal letters, I couldn't find any proof that they were true. On the contrary, Cobb's teammates on the whole seemed to respect him, defending him on the field and off. His opponents said he played the game hard but clean. Wally Shang, a veteran catcher, was typical. He once said, "Cobb never cut me up. He was too pretty a slider to hurt anyone who put the ball on him right." One famous photograph from 1912 shows Cobb flying foot first into the crotch of St. Louis Browns catcher Paul Critchell. It looks bad, but pictures can be deceiving. In reality, Cobb is kicking the ball out of Critchell's glove. He didn't spike the catcher. Critchell later said, "In a way, it was really my fault. I was standing in front of the plate instead of on the side where I could tag Ty as he slid in." Indeed, in 1910, Cobb actually asked the league to require that players dull their spikes. And what about the bigotry? How could a man born in Georgia in 1886 not be a racist? Well, as it turns out, Ty Cobb descended from a long line of abolitionists. Wow. His great-grandfather was a minister who preached against slavery and was run out of town for his troubles. His grandfather refused to fight in the Confederate Army because of the slavery issue.
Wow.
And his father, an educator, once broke up a lynch mob. On the subjects of blacks playing with whites, Cobb said, "The Negro should be accepted wholeheartedly and not grudgingly. The Negro has the right to play professional baseball, and who's to say he has not?"
Doesn't sound like
Cobb attended many Negro League games, sometimes throwing out the first pitch and sitting in the dugout with the players. He said Willie Mays was the only modern-day player he'd pay to see. As for that black waiter he supposedly killed, well, in reality, he was a hotel night watchman, and Cobb didn't kill him. He just scuffled with him, and oh, yeah, the guy was white. Now, Ty Cobb was like the rest of us, a highly imperfect being, too quick to take offense, too intolerant of those who did not strive for excellence with the same almost crazy zeal that he did. But a racist, a dirty player? Not true. What is true, that almost every accusation against Ty Cobb's character finds its roots in the same source, unfact-checked articles and books published after his death by a bitter, opportunistic journalist named Al Stump, whom Cobb had once threatened to sue for making up stories about him.
Wow,
it didn't matter that Stump had spent little time with Cobb, or that all of Stump's sources were anonymous, that sports writers who knew Cobb rushed to his defense, or that Stump himself had been banned from publications for writing lies.
Wow.
The scandal was titillating, and it stuck. When the legend beats the facts, print the legend. Meanwhile, a good man's reputation lies in ruins. There are lessons to be learned here. First, it's all too easy to believe lies about people, especially successful ones. Lies take achievers down a few notches, and we like to hear that. And second, if a lie is repeated often enough, it becomes accepted as fact. This has consequences, because lies are the source of much of the world's evil, like the evil of destroying a man's legacy. In this case, a legacy that should be celebrated. Ty Cobb was the most exciting baseball player of all time. He once stole second, third, and home on three consecutive pitches. He once
tried
a tap back to the pitcher into an inside-the-park home run.
That's
he was not a racist or a cheat. It's time to tell the truth about Ty Cobb.
Yeah.
I'm Charles Learson, author of Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty.
I mean, that's everything everything you didn't believe about Ty Cobb in 5 minutes.
Nothing is sacred anymore.
That's amazing.
It's incredible, too. And you think about it in today's context with fake news. First of all, fake news has been going on a long time, apparently. This is
fake news. If anybody doesn't think that, you know, the king was paying the town criers to go out and cry out with fake news, you're crazy.
Please.
Of course they were.
It's been going on forever.
Right.
I mean, and you see this. This is one. I mean, even as a person who has spent way too many hours focusing on sports. We're all huge sports fans, with the exception, of course, Glenn, who doesn't know the difference between baseball and football.
I do.
You do?
Yes.
Okay.
The ball size.
Yes, right. That's it. That's the only difference. But I mean,
good.
We spent a lot of time talking about baseball.
And
baseball
the color.
History.
One's brown, one's white.
And there you go.
Shape.
You go. Very good.
You could go with the shape.
You could go with a lot of
give them the answers.
A little bit different.
Okay, the shape. The
point is,
I said one's smaller, one's bigger.
Point is, I even believed it, right? Like, I mean, I totally thought that was true. Great player, dirtbag.
Yep.
That was my whole, you know, you just believe that about Ty Cobb. And you realize,
that's always the name that comes up when you're talking about Pete Rose in the Hall of Fame. You're telling me Ty Cobb's in the Hall of Fame, but not Pete Rose? Look what he did compared to Pete Rose. I've heard that 100 times.
Yeah. And look at like, we all recognize this is true in the area, like, for example, politics. You know, FDR ended the Great Depression. Like, all these things that we know, over time you look at and you're like, wait a minute, that's not right. This isn't right. But when we get to, there's a certain level of interest. Like, if you hit, like, with sports, like, I'm interested in Ty Cobb because I think it's, you know, I like sports. But, like, I dedicated my life to looking at Ty Cobb like this author has. And it's like, when you actually look at these things so many times, they're the opposite. I mean,
Tokyo Rose.
What struck me, Tokyo Rose, you've done with Tokyo Rose.
Woodrow Wilson.
Woodrow Wilson.
It struck me, what hit me initially, because it was a sports reference, was we had John Ziegler in here a couple weeks ago talking about the Penn State thing, and Joe Paterno being the main part of that, of like, here's a guy who was fired, his reputation ruined. And really, in retrospect, it's pretty hard to make the case that Paterno in particular, I mean, Ziegler goes even further than this, but Paterno in particular, it's hard to make the case that this guy had a lengthy knowledge of these things and did something horrific because he wanted to endanger children. It's bizarre when you stop and you can get past the sort of craziness of the moment and really examine these things, how your opinion changes.
I would love to hear, and in fact, you know, I guess I send it to Pat Gray at glennbeck.com. I would like to hear who has been besmirched, who needs to be restored.
That'd be really interesting.
Yeah, whose credibility has been destroyed that needs to have it restored? And let's take it out of the last 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, because you can't.
It's hard.
It's too controversial in the last 20 years.
And because it doesn't end at Ty Cobb and Tokyo Rose. There's got to be hundreds of people.
I mean, that Tokyo Rose thing blew me away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Blew me away.
We had no idea.
Yeah.
None.
You know, another thing I thought of is we should start, because when Tokyo Rose, she died in 2006. She died in 2006.
She was alive a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, most of my life she was alive.
Yeah.
Why didn't I ever talk to Tokyo Rose? Why didn't I ever reach out to Tokyo Rose?
We didn't know the story then.
Right. But even not knowing the story, what happened? Why wouldn't we do that?
Mm-hmm.
Who was it? Somebody that just died. And then today I saw the picture, the guy who, do you remember that really famous firefighter in the Oklahoma City bombing that was carrying the baby, the little girl? Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
He's just retired.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's hard to believe because he was young in that. He's just retired from the fire department. We should find people from history, the Tokyo Rose size, that are here available and just nobody's talking to before they die.
Yeah, we should.
You know what I mean? I'd love to talk to some of those people.
By the way, do you know that Ty Cobb hit over 400 three separate years?
See, this is
going to happen now for 3 weeks.
Easily.
Like, we will be in the middle of a conversation about something totally different. And like, do you know he hit 420 one year? 420. 420.
And that's all he'll say.
Of all time.
That's all he'll say. And we'll all go, huh. And then right back into the conversation.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Hello, and welcome to the program.
I like your idea of finding these characters. What is it, Pat Gray at glennbeck.com?
Yes.
If you have someone from history who you think needs to be rehabilitated, or maybe is it, what about the other side, Glenn? If it's someone who's thought of as this god,
you know,
that you can take down.
Edison. Think of what we have learned ourselves.
Yeah.
Edison.
George Bernard Shaw.
George Bernard Shaw.
That's a great one.
Horrible guy.
We do a segment on Wonderful World of Sue called Ruining Your Heroes, which is kind of this, although it's, the negative side of it I've chosen. But I mean, any of these, because there's so many from history that have just been screwed.
He's still heralded. Woodrow Wilson is still among the top
presidents. I think by the time I retire,
we might have done the job.
You might have done the job. 6th to 11th in the last poll.
I mean, he is starting to be known.
The left is even starting to acknowledge he was a racist.
Horrible, horrible racist.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
This is the Blaze Radio on demand.
Hello, America. Last week we were talking about how ISPs are taking your data. The government just decided to roll back the laws that were made during the Obama administration. And Cullen Hoback was supposed to be with us, and we had a technical glitch. We wanted to bring him in because he is really, truly fascinating. He's done a couple of movies, Monster Camp and Terms and Conditions May Apply. Terms and Conditions May Apply, really where we want to go with him. One of the leading voices on what did you just sign when you just clicked OK? We go there right now.
Of entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Cullen, welcome to the program. How are you?
Oh, very good today.
Good.
Glad to be in studio.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. We wanted to talk to you about this ISP discussion that was going on last week with the government rolling it back. And we had a discussion here that I don't like the government getting involved in private relationships. I have a relationship with a company. If I don't like it, I'll go switch to another company.
Right.
You are saying that there is a difference between that and Apple. The ISP is different than Apple.
Well, I mean, the ISP is very different than a Google or a Facebook, right? Because with a company like Google, it's a search engine company primarily. They also provide email, but you can go to some other search engine. You can
ask
use
Jeeves.
DuckDuckGo. Yeah, you can ask Jeeves if you wanted to. and same with Facebook. There are other social media tools out there, and they're free. An ISP, we're already paying, you know, however much they can charge us, depending on how much competition is in the region,
mm-hmm.
right? And many people only have one option, especially when it comes to a higher speed broadband. So what we're essentially saying now is that, you know, you get the internet or you don't. And if you want the internet, well, everything you do online now is the property of that internet provider.
As far as terms and conditions apply, how did this start with you? Did you just, were you curious about what all these rules and regulations were that we were agreeing to? And then you started reading them? How did this begin?
It was a lot of boring reading.
Yeah,
I bet it was.
So you actually did read the terms and conditions that do apply.
I did. Yeah.
Wow.
And that actually,
you are the one.
In fact, actually, a lot of these companies just copy paste other companies' terms and conditions.
Do they really?
Yeah, they don't even want
word
have
for
to
word
read them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this happens.
And so, how long are these things generally? And what's the longest you've seen?
I think, it's between Apple and LinkedIn. LinkedIn has some of the most egregious terms, and Apple's is out to protect themselves. They're not really in the business of taking your data because mm-hmm. they're trying to sell you a really expensive product.
Right.
So Apple, you'll just read through everything they've got. I mean, they go to the extent to protect themselves from an incident where you may use their technology to start a nuclear war. So they actually, if you read in their
seriously?
Terms, yeah, they say we are not responsible if our technology, you are not allowed to use it for this purpose. Therefore, if you do, we are not liable.
What could I possibly buy on iTunes that could start a nuclear war?
Well, the documentary War Games.
Talk to Kim Jong-un. Yeah, right? Kim Jong-un or something. Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
It's a message just for him.
Yeah. Wow.
So how much trouble are we in with privacy? For instance, Stu and I, it used to be the biggest advocate of keeping our fingerprints sacred. You're not taking my fingerprints. And we've handed them over.
Yes.
And we actually don't mind it now because we're so mentally lazy.
In fact, Stu loves it.
I was telling Colin off the air because I had him on Wonderful World of Stu, I don't know, 3 years ago or something.
Yeah.
It was right when the fingerprint thing came out for iPhones and I didn't have it yet. And I remember it was kind of a story at the time. Wow, you're putting your fingerprint in these things, and it's digital, and you know, maybe it is locally stored, but still, it was like another step of you were giving up to technology. And at the time, we were talking about that, and I was critical of it in that, like, just like, this kind of freaks me out. Now, the 1/10 of a second that saves me every time I log into my phone is irreplaceable. I would fall on my sword to defend it. And because at any time you can improve convenience just a little bit, these things seem to go down the tubes.
And you're right. I mean, with each step, we're just turning up the heat on ourselves a little bit more. Mm. You know, and the Constitution guarantees us a reasonable right to privacy. So what's our reasonable expectation of privacy? And when we come to accept fingerprint scanning, or we come to accept going through an airport and, you know, having mm-hmm. some kind of naked monitoring of our bodies. I mean, mm-hmm. the bar keeps getting pushed back. And so now I think when it comes to all of the technologies that we're using and our experiences online, what are we willing to accept? And I think that it's very difficult right now for people to feel the cost of digital services spying on them because they can't see it. Mm-hmm. And what you can't see is hard to feel.
Like, what should we feel every time?
I mean, you should feel like a bunch of hundreds of weird people you've never met are looking through your window, rifling through your diary, getting into your brain and trying to know you better than you know yourself.
And they truly are doing this. They're going through all our stuff.
Everything.
Or is it just
you do
there
online,
and they could go through it if they wanted to?
Well, there's not some person sitting around, you know, with a
and they're not looking. They're not looking at Pat per se.
Right.
They're looking at metadata.
Habits. Yeah.
Well, who is they?
Friends.
I don't know. You're the one who's giving me
conspiracy theory. You have the companies, right? And then you have the government. And there really is no separation between the two.
Really?
That's a big problem.
Why do you say that?
The government has access to the things that Google and Apple collect?
Yes. I mean, this is what Edward Snowden and the prison program showed us, is that there was backdoor access. And there is something called the third-party doctrine. And it's a ruling from the early 80s, which says if you give your information to a third party, a Google, a Facebook, a bank, you've given up your right to control that information.
And that includes going to the government.
And so it is it's way easier for the government to go to one of those companies and get our information than get it directly from us. There's virtually no firewall there.
Let's get into the time tunnel, Glenn, and go back 3 days. Now, how do you feel? changes it, though, right? That changes it because the government is involved. It's not just selling to private companies. The government does
but
have that.
But the problem you have there is the firewall between government and corporation.
Yeah, I still don't think the government should be passing laws. I mean, that's just like passing another bad gun law. Pass the right law. Put a firewall in between the government and the private companies.
And we've argued with that on the Snowden, you know, with all the Snowden information. I mean, we disagree with a lot of people who would be conservative in the audience and a lot of the candidates that ran last year because a lot of them embrace that sort of NSA needs to be seeing everything that you're doing. And, and we are not on that bandwagon. The conversation initially started here, and it's an interesting one in that with this ISP ruling where they're talking about, can your ISP sell the data? Pat was arguing, I think the same way that you're arguing is no, you have this agreement. And we were kind of arguing, I don't want the government involved in that. I don't want the government to make a rule saying they
mandate.
Can't. And my issue with that is, while I agree with you, it's a terrible policy. And it should be one of those things that they shouldn't do. They should not sell your data. But even if, let's just take it to a crazy extreme, there's only one provider, and they say everything that you search for, we're going to publicly put on our Twitter page with your name and face. And we are going to identify every aspect of what you've done online publicly every single time, and we're your only option. Still, the government does not have a role there because of the fact that the government does not give you the right to get on the internet. If a corporation decides to build the infrastructure that lets you get on the internet, well, then they can put the terms that they want to allow you to access it. It's not the government's job to guarantee you access.
And Pat, I want to just say that my argument hasn't changed. Your argument has changed. You're saying because the government...
No, it hasn't, Glenn. No, it hasn't.
Your argument has changed. You're saying that, well, now, Glenn, your argument has changed because the government can get it. Well, no. What he's saying is the government's getting it whether they sell it or not. The government's getting it.
Yeah.
So the problem is not selling it. The problem is
the government is getting it. But
right.
Well,
but
I think one key factor here. I think we can all agree we like the Constitution. Right?
Yes,
we're fans.
And, big fans here.
Right now, the Constitution doesn't apply
on anything.
Yeah,
it doesn't apply.
Fourth Amendment in particular.
Yeah, it doesn't follow us into the digital realm. And so, when the government, I think, passes laws related to the Constitution on the internet, we're not talking about egregious regulations. We're talking about constitutional regulation, which is different. It's different. In essence, they are blocking themselves from easily getting access to this information, though ISPs are required to retain. I think we should be moving more in the direction of ways to stop the government from being able to access
this
information.
Yes, I agree.
That's
because the Constitution is a document on what the government can do, not what a private corporation can do or can't do.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a right to privacy in my. I have a implied contract of privacy with Apple, but not a constitutional right to privacy with Apple. That's the government. I have a constitutional right to privacy with the government, and they're not fulfilling that in any way, shape, or form. And they're trying to look like they're great guys by saying, oh, look, we're protecting your privacy with the ISP. No, you're not. No, you're not. You're not filling your fundamental mandate of the Fourth Amendment in the first place. So this is just all a puppet show.
So if there was a, say your phone provider suddenly developed a tool where they could hear all of your thoughts, and maybe they didn't tell you that this was going
yes.
on, is there then a role for the government to say, no, you can't record people's thoughts and not let them know about that?
If they didn't tell people, yes. But I think there would be such an uproar that this phone company had installed this and didn't let anybody know about it.
So many, many years ago, when I first made Terms and Conditions, I discovered, it wasn't me, there were lots of technologists who knew that there were key loggers recording every single thing that we do on our phones, all of it without our knowledge. There was never uproar.
Did we agree to that in their terms and conditions?
No.
No?
No. But they would have some way to justify it. If you're a good lawyer, you can kind of come up with some wishy-washy way to describe
it. Right. Yeah.
But they weren't specifically saying, we are recording every stroke.
Does the AI thing bother you at all, that there doesn't seem to be any restraint on anyone anymore? You know, in especially in technology, it's not should we do it, it's can we do it? Can it be done? Yeah, okay, do it. There's no, doesn't
should.
Seem to be real ethics applied on a lot of things. And when we get into AI, we're starting to get into territory now that things are going to change so rapidly, and we're going to really be boxed in to, I mean, you know, fingerprints. 6 years ago, we're not going to use fingerprints. How dare you think of it? Now, okay, because it's convenient. Brave New World was correct, not 1984. They're just packaging everything the way we want it. Is there any concern with you on where we're headed?
I mean, if you look at what's happened with privacy since basically the advent of the internet, the march is moving more and more away, more and more towards just this kind of idea of total transparency. Mm. But that total transparency doesn't seem to apply to the government.
Right, that's
right?
For sure.
So
yeah.
They want us to be as transparent as possible, have as much access to everything that we're doing. But then,
should be the opposite way.
Yeah,
who's
watching the watchers, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And when you talk about this kind of technology, it is in direct relationship to how much information is shared and captured in the background. It's part of Google's master plan. It's why they want us to share all of our right. searches and desires with them.
Edward Snowden, hero, traitor, somewhere in between.
It's somewhere in between. I consider him a patriot. He made that decision not for his own benefit. He lived a pretty sweet life in Hawaii, making a decent wage with a pretty hot girlfriend. So things were not bad for him. I'm going to tell you they're a lot worse in Russia for him right now than they were before.
Sure.
I think what's a challenge here for him, or for me at least, with what he did, he released documents that were beyond just domestic spying. So you had release of documents related to Angela Merkel. Mm-hmm. You had release of documents related to spy programs abroad. And that's where I think things start to get kind of gray. I wish he'd just focused on domestic. But again, mm-hmm. we're talking about one individual, tens of thousands of documents. Mm-hmm. It was difficult for him to go through that. And he trusted a news outlet to then, you know, disseminate information in a way that was responsible. So that's where I think it's gray.
What I find so incredible is that we went through the Snowden thing. All the conspiracy theorists leading up to that would have said, this is happening. And then Edward Snowden shows that it was actually happening.
And
that
nobody
cared. And we still are going down this road faster and faster and faster.
Is that crazy?
I thought everything was going to change.
I did
after
too.
Edward Snowden came out with those documents.
Not
I was
all.
So hopeful. And the only thing that Congress passed was something that separates their ability to directly have metadata. And now it's in the hands of the company. But we know that they can easily
it's
just
crazy.
Get it from the company.
Right.
That's
amazing.
All that really changed.
Everything in the last, since Snowden and this last election, everything I thought about the American people I'm like, no,
we don't know.
You know, you keep using that word, American people. I do not think it means what you think it means. Thank you so much for being on with us.
Really
appreciate it.
Yeah, glad I was in town.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Well, where should people go to check out your stuff?
Oh, sure. Well, this film was Terms and Conditions May Apply. Mm-hmm. The new one's What Lies Upstream. And actually, I was in Dallas. At the Dallas International Film Festival with this new project.
Oh, very cool.
Awesome.
Again, it's investigating corruption.
And are they coming out to theaters?
The top federal level.
Or is it on the internet? How's it being released?
It'll be in theaters. It'll be on TV come the fall.
All right, great.
Awesome. So, yeah, there's lots of ways to see it.
Good. Send us a preview copy so we can see it. I'd love to see it.
We'll do. Yeah, we'll be able to have a spirited conversation about corruption at the EPA.
So. Oh, wow. Yeah, you'll be back.
I'm sure that's
you'll be
zero.
Back. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Really fascinating. Talking to Cullen off air, I just asked him, you know, are you concerned about technology?
We need to stop
happening?
Talking to people I after know. Interviews. Because it say, never turns out well.
Thanks for coming on and get out.
Thanks. Now don't say another word. Just leave us alone.
He said, you know, I'm at this place where I'm wondering, is technology going to destroy us or set us free?
And it's kind of a race to see which happens first.
Right. And it really is. The promise of technology is more freedom than mankind has ever known.
Uh-huh.
But if we don't guard it and we're not careful, it will mean a global prison camp. It's just which one gets there first. And it all relies on us. As he was talking about Edward Snowden, you know.
Nobody cared.
So as these things start to happen, if nobody cares about the Constitution, if nobody cares about rights, if nobody cares that the government is doing that, oh, well, of course they're doing that. Well, then it's going to get worse and worse and worse. It's up to us to care and be consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Know what our principles are.
What's that word? I don't think I understand the term.
Consistent. I'm not sure what it means.
Okay.
I used to think that it means you believe in something and you apply that.
No matter who's president, you still have the same belief structure.
Right. Right.
Weird.
But I don't think that works. The guy where that did work, consistency, Calvin Coolidge. Cereal on him. You are going to love this week of cereals. Calvin Coolidge, the greatest president of the 20th century, you don't know anything about. Next.
The Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program.
When it comes to American presidents, scholars and historians alike love to sing the praises of progressives like Franklin Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. FDR is continually voted one of our top five presidents ever, despite the fact that he actually prolonged the Great Depression by at least a decade, interning the Japanese Americans, and he increased the size of the federal government exponentially. Until recently, Wilson was also a perennial top 10 member. Even though he was known to be an extreme racist, he also interned American citizens. He broke his promise to keep America out of war. He instituted the federal income tax. I mean, who doesn't love that? And he began the Federal Reserve. And he had an open distaste for both the Declaration of Independence and the United States Constitution. He was one of the worst presidents the United States has ever had. Inexplicably, these same scholars and historians always take a decidedly negative approach when assessing our 30th American president, Calvin Coolidge. There was a recent C-SPAN poll and Coolidge ranked just 27th. Hardly awe-inspiring, yet his presidency actually was. I'm going to go over the details of what made him a much better president than he was given credit for on upcoming episodes. But first, let's start at the beginning. Appropriately, Calvin Coolidge was born on our nation's 96th birthday, July 4th, 1872. He was born in Plymouth Notch, Vermont. Amity Schles of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation, friend of the program, one of the best authors out there, author of the must-read book, The Forgotten Man, and the book Coolidge, describes young Calvin's early years.
Coolidge was from a wonderful family, and the family had a lot of depth. So the Coolidges had a commitment to public life, to service, and to going into government.
Sadly, Coolidge's childhood was stricken by tragedy when his mother died. Calvin was only 12 years old, and his only sibling, his younger sister, passed away when he was 18.
He almost didn't make it to teen years. He was kind of a sickly boy. He almost didn't make it into college. He had to stay out a year. He almost didn't make it as an attorney in Northampton when he started his career. He almost didn't find a wife, and yet each time he succeeded. So he's a very inspiring fellow because he was not a huge standout. He was not number one in his class. He was not the guy everybody loved, and yet he prevailed through sheer hard work.
As historian and author of the book Calvin Coolidge, a documentary biography, David Petruzza explains, most didn't see the potential in the younger Calvin.
Calvin Coolidge is not exactly the most likely to succeed even in college, even as a young man. Even for a 19th century Vermonter, he's taciturn, withdrawn. He's not courted by any of the fraternities at school. His associate Dwight Murrow is. He will become eventually Coolidge's ambassador to Mexico. No one thinks much of Calvin Coolidge's chances except for Morrow, who does see something in Coolidge. Because if you look beyond the silent exterior, you see a very solid interior. And when he runs for office, when the people take a look at what Coolidge has to offer, they know this is a person they can trust. This is a person who is not going to pander to them. And he is going to work for their best interest as a whole, not necessarily for special interest, but for rising up the country and the economy as a whole.
Turns out Dwight was right. It really is hard to get more successful than the President of the United States, especially at that time. Most of these traits that Dwight Morrow recognized were instilled in a young Calvin by his father, who was honest and hardworking. John Calvin Coolidge, Sr. He was known throughout Vermont as a prosperous farmer, a storekeeper, and a public servant. More from Amity Schles.
In some families, people are just expressions of the family. You know, the son is the father's ambassador, or the other way. The Coolidges were like that.
Coolidge ended up graduating cum laude from Amherst with a law degree. He opened up his own practice in 1898, and along the way, Coolidge became interested in a political career. Well, that same year, he won the election to the Northampton City Council. Later, he was elected to the offices of city solicitor and clerk of courts. Now, as the clerk of courts, he wasn't allowed to practice law, so he stayed in his office for just a year. And instead, in 1904, he ran for a position on the school board, suffering the only loss at the ballot box of his political career. He was told by several neighbors that the reason they didn't vote for him for the office was that he didn't have any children who would be going to the schools in which he would govern. To that, Coolidge replied, "You might give me some time." In fact, starting a family would be just around the corner for Coolidge, as Petruzza explains.
Calvin Coolidge is a young bachelor attorney in Northampton, Massachusetts, and one day he is shaving, and Grace Goodhue walks by and sees this young fellow shaving, but he's shaving in a sort of odd way. He's wearing a derby hat for some reason as he's doing this, and she looks up and bursts into laughter. And he looks down, and instead of being annoyed by that, he knows a good thing or a good woman when he sees one, and determines that he is going to court her. And while he is not the most overtly courtly courting kind, he certainly succeeds in his courtship with her, and they will marry not too long afterwards.
In 1905, Coolidge married Grace Ann Goodhue.
The couple had two children, John, who was born in 1906 and who, believe it or not, lived long enough to see the beginning of the presidential campaign between Al Gore and George W. Bush in 2000, and Calvin Jr., who, just at 16 years old, in a bizarre twist of fate, developed a simple blister on his toe. This will make you appreciate modern-day medicine. That blister became infected, and he died of blood poisoning. And the loss was devastating to Calvin and his wife. In 1906, he ran for and was elected to the Massachusetts House of Representatives. Ironically, at this time of his life, Coolidge was known as a progressive Republican, mostly over his support for women's right to vote and direct election of the senators. He served two terms in the House before returning home to spend more time with his family, and while there, was elected twice as the city's mayor. During his first term as mayor in Northampton, he increased teachers' salaries and paid down much of the city's debt while still managing to provide residents with slight tax decreases. His conservative policies paid huge dividends his entire career, and Coolidge became more and more popular. So much so that when the state senator from his area retired, he went to Coolidge to encourage him to run for his seat in the 1912 session. Coolidge agreed and won the seat easily. So now, here he is, at the time of Wilson, in the Senate. And after two very successful terms in the state Senate, Coolidge was ready to retire, as was the custom of the time. But the president of the Senate was defeated in his election, so he decided to run for a third term. He won the seat again. And as Petruzza explains, Coolidge won more than that.
Coolidge has done all this work with his fellow legislators. Within 24 hours, he has sewed up the votes to be the next Senate president, and he has, beyond the Republicans voting for him, he has a good share of the Democrats. The next year, when he's reelected for the Senate, he is elected unanimously. Every Democrat in the House votes for him. He has a way of reaching out to Democrats and to Catholics and to the Irish, which are, of course, so important in Massachusetts politics.
Coolidge was riding really high in Massachusetts politics, and in 1914, as Senate president, he delivered this popular and very memorable speech to the state and his colleagues, entitled, "Have Faith in Massachusetts."
Do the day's work. If it be to protect the rights of the weak, whoever objects, do it. If it be to help a powerful corporation better to serve the people, whatever the opposition, do that. Expect to be called a stand-patter, but don't be a stand-patter. Expect to be called a demagogue, but don't be a demagogue. Don't hesitate to be as revolutionary as science. Don't hesitate to be as reactionary as the multiplication table. Don't expect to build up the weak by pulling down the strong. Don't hurry to legislate. Give administration a chance to catch up with legislation.
The speech propelled him to new heights and caught the interest of power brokers in the state and around the nation, some of whom believed he was now ready to run for lieutenant governor or even governor. Coolidge was convinced that this was the time to aim even higher, and he entered the primary election for lieutenant governor. He was nominated to run alongside gubernatorial candidate Samuel W. McCall. Coolidge was the leading vote-getter in the Republican primary, and in 1915, the pair were elected to their first one-year term. They won again in 1916, 17, and when McCall stepped aside in 1918, Coolidge ran for governor on a platform of fiscal conservatism, lukewarm opposition to prohibition, support for women's suffrage, and support for America's involvement in World War I. Now, the war at the time was a hugely divisive issue for him, especially among the Irish and German Americans, which may have been the reason that Coolidge was elected only by a margin of 16,733 votes over his opponent. That was his smallest margin of victory in any statewide election. So here he is as governor, waiting to rise to national prominence. His time came when he had to crush a police strike. It happened in Boston, and he took on the powerful and legendary AFL president Samuel Gompers in the process. Coolidge took strong and decisive steps from the start of the strike, relieving the police commissioner of his duties. He then called in the National Guard, and he personally took control of the police force. Once order was restored, he placed the police commissioner back in his position and then fired every single striking officer. Coolidge then put out the call for an entirely new police force. When I first read this, I thought, boy, this sounds like what Ronald Reagan did to the striking air traffic controllers back in his term. It's probably not a coincidence in seeing that Ronald Reagan's favorite president was Calvin Coolidge. When Gompers attempted to enforce his will on the situation, firing off a protesting telegram to Coolidge, the popular governor responded publicly, emphatically stating in part,
"There is no right to strike against the public safety by anyone, anywhere, anytime. I am equally determined to defend the sovereignty of Massachusetts and to maintain the authority and jurisdiction over her public officers where it has been placed by the Constitution and laws of her people."
Sound like Reagan? Calvin Coolidge became an instant national conservative hero. They had found someone finally, they believed, that if necessary, could stand against the Red Scare of communism that had gripped the country in light of the recent revolutions in Russia, Hungary, and in Germany. Again, doesn't that sound an awful lot like Ronald Reagan? Who, coincidentally, when Coolidge was president, Ronald Reagan was a young man. The stage was now set for Calvin Coolidge to realize his full potential. In 1920, destiny would come calling, literally, on the phone. We tell that story next time.
Tomorrow on the Glenn Beck Program, in Chapter 2 of our serial on Calvin Coolidge, you'll learn about Coolidge's first experience in the White House. Listen live or online at glennbeck.com/serials.
This is
the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
This is
the Glenn Beck Program.
Listen to this. I'm just going to give you a tease of this article. Hopefully we'll get to it next hour. We have Mark Duplass on in just a minute. I'm really excited. This is one of the first interviews where all of us are really excited for different reasons to talk to somebody. Listen to this. Everyone, despite income, should be encouraged to take care of their health. I actually like socialized medicine, Sharon, one of the focus group participants, told us. This was unexpected. Socialized medicine, Canadian-style healthcare, single-payer, whatever you want to call it, that's typically championed by the far left. Bernie Sanders has proposed a single-payer plan during his presidential run. Progressive legislators in California and New York have introduced single-payer bills in their respective state houses. But at our focus group, our participants were onto something. Lately, there's been a surprising groundswell of support for universal coverage, even single-payer, among Trump voters. This was a focus group of Trump supporters, and they're all starting to turn towards single-payer healthcare. Congratulations, America. More on this, because this article will blow your mind. Coming up.
Glenn Beck.
Mercury.
This is the Blaze Radio on demand.
So for the last few years, I have been saying that we need to get out of our own little bubble. We need to start listening to people, start talking to people, and we need to take responsibility for what we've done. Don't worry about what others have done, and start to come together on things that really matter, and serve one another. Well, I'm driving home from South by Southwest a couple of weeks ago, and I saw an interview with Mark Duplass, who is a film director, an actor, producer, he's made just a great, great movie called Blue Jay. I don't know if anybody's ever seen it, but it's just tremendous. And I'm watching this interview, and he says, I'm going to give $25,000 to anybody on the right. If we can just come together, I'm going to donate it to a charity. Let's reach out to each other. Let's start working together. Let's just start having conversations. So I immediately wrote to him and have been waiting for this conversation. He is on the phone. He joins us right now.
Of entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Mark Duplass, welcome to the program, sir.
How are you, sir? Thanks for having me.
Very good. First of all, let's just start with this. We're big fans. I didn't know Stu was a big fan of yours.
Oh, The League is a tremendous, legendary show.
And I have seen, I've seen Blue Jay. And Pat actually saw parts of it as well. And it is, I mean, it's just genius work. It's just genius work.
Thank you so much. So, thank you very much.
You're welcome. So let's start here. First of all, the audience should know that this never happens. Mark calls in, and in our producers talked to him a couple of weeks ago, and he said, look, I don't want you to, please don't promote anything of mine. Don't talk about anything of mine. I just really want to have a conversation about what's happening in the world. I just wanted you to know that that's the kind of character this guy has coming to the table. You are a Hollywood guy. You're obviously on the left and unashamed of being on the left.
I'd go so far as to say I'm a self-professed semi-elitist Hollywood libtard. I mean, I'll go ahead and I'll take it, man.
Okay. All right. So what are you doing?
First of all, I don't really know. I'm jumping into some things without being fully educated about what these consequences are, but something in my deep gut has been telling me that the divide we are experiencing right now politically is obviously, it's gotten so incendiary and it's gotten so gridlocked that quite frankly, it dovetails with something that while I am not as politically astute as and well-read as most people who are having these conversations, I've made my whole life about relationships and about the healing of relationships,
yeah,
about going to therapy over relationships.
Right.
I work with and sleep next to my wife every night. My brother and I run a business together. My parents and I live 2 miles from each other, and we see each other every Sunday. I know deeply what it's like to be close with people and how to work through issues. And when I sense the way that people are communicating to each other, so gridlocked in their positions, just firing away with incendiary criticism, I thought to myself, I think I know how to operate in this space a little bit, so I'm going to try to jump in and see what I have to offer.
So what do you have to offer to Mark?
Well, I guess, you know, the first thing that I noticed is, you know, it feels like the country's in a terrible marriage right now or of some sort where you get to that point where you're just like, you know what, I can't even have a civil conversation with you because I feel like I'm constantly under attack. And you know, look, I've been there in relationships before. I think everybody has to a certain degree. And you know, my whole theory is like that movie and that book Love Story that came out in like 1970, I think did a terrible disservice to all relationships by propagating that quote, love means never having to say you're sorry, which to me is the worst thing you can possibly
it's an amazing right. It's an amazing falsehood.
Yeah, it really is.
To me, we're in the place where love means always having to say you're sorry, even if at times you're pretty sure it's the other person's fault.
Amen.
You need to just step up for a second and just say, hey, I probably did some of this. I'm sorry for that. And let the healing begin. You know, my wife and I always joke, like, when we get to that gridlocked place, we have to go to the lowest common denominator of connection. And that for us is we put on the Big Lebowski and we get a six pack of beer and we sit next to each other and we just enjoy it. And we don't talk. And then the good vibes start to happen. And then slowly one of us says, hey, I'll order some Thai food. Let me do it. And then the other person says, oh, that was nice. And then the other person brings in the Thai food. And then literally, brick by brick, you get yourself back to the place of good feeling and communication. So I started thinking, like, what is the lowest common denominator here between, you know, conservatives, between liberals? Like, what is something that we can share without screaming? And I thought to myself, well, you know, what about charitable giving? I continually hear, you know, that conservatives actually give more to charity than a lot of liberals do. And I know that a lot of that is church-based, and everybody can get into an argument about that, but whatever, put that away. Everybody likes to take care of sick children. Everybody believes that clean water systems installed in third world countries for relatively cheap that are sustainable are a good thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, what if I can find some, you know, just reach out a little bit and find some of these campaigns that maybe we could share and in the positive spirit of giving without yelling at each other, just focus on the giving. Maybe you might grow something. I don't know. It's still early. I'm all half baked in my head, to be honest, but this is the pool I'm trying to step into at the moment.
How does it make you feel that is exactly the same pool that Glenn Beck stepped into?
You better run.
What does that say about you, Mark? Really? Seriously?
That says you better not open up your Twitter page.
I mean, it's phenomenal. I mean, honestly, this is like all I am looking for right now is a connection point. And I was so guilty in mid-November of like getting on Twitter and proselytizing about why I was right and finding new and interesting and multisyllabic ways to slam Trump, you know,
see another point in common.
Exactly. So I look back and I'm like, why am I doing this? This is at best further marginalizing us, you know, and at worst, just losing half of my fans who don't even care about what I'm saying now. And I just started to think this doesn't feel like the right way. And deep in my gut, I know that when my brother and I get into emotional trouble, when my wife and I, when my friends and I, when my parents do, that always the way forward is to, regardless of whether who started it, regardless of who was more unfair or who was louder with their words, I always know deep in my gut, I have to step forward first. I have to be the one. I would love it if someone else did it, but you know what? Who cares? Put that away. Be the one, step forward. And when you do that, it usually ends up working out pretty well. So, you know, for me, the fact that, like, you heard that and you reached out and said, you know, come on my program and let's talk about this, this is super exciting to me because I guess I'm in a bit of a fact-gathering mode. Like, I first started talking to people with the question of, if you held your nose and voted for Trump, I get you. I have nothing against that, honestly. Like, nobody has a favorite politician anymore. You know, we're too aware of the machinations. We read too much news. So if you just thought to yourself, you know what? There's a Supreme Court justice coming up long term. I want to get a GOP guy in there so that, you know, I'll get the right appointee, or I am a one issue voter, such as, you know, I'm a pro-life voter. Like, I can understand that. But if you're on fire for Trump, if you're in love with the guy, tell me why, you know,
like we can't that, help that, you. With, yeah. We can't help you with that, Mark. I don't know if you know anything about us at all, but we can't help you
I
on
do.
That one.
And yeah. I do. And you know,
we
what?
Feel the exactly out, the same way.
No one is on fire for Trump. There are a couple of really frightening people on Twitter who are in love with Trump. But by the way, there are just as many of those frightening people on the left. So that's not a party divide thing. There's always the outliers there. So what I have learned, interestingly enough, in doing that is no one's on fire. There are, tons of reasons. And the last thing I want to do is be reductive in any way about a large group of people who might have voted for him. But I keep getting these really, I guess, fascinating answers for me, which are sort of like, I felt hopeless. I felt Obama left me behind. This guy was a Hail Mary. I didn't know what he was going to do. He was an other, and I felt the lack of political jargon. I felt that his candor and just the feeling that he was being truthful and his words weren't well rehearsed made them feel like he was like them. So they said, I want to take a chance on him. Okay, that I can actually understand. You know, people saying he's telling me he's going to bring jobs. No one is talking to me and saying that they're going to bring jobs. I'm choosing to believe him. So, okay, I can get behind that too. I can understand where you're coming from. So I guess the 30,000 foot view of it for me has been, you know, I live in Los Angeles and I do live in a bubble, you know, and as much as I tell myself, you know, I open up my Twitter feed, I look at Fox News once a day to see what's happening. You know, the truth is, I'm mostly hearing from people who are terrified of this man, and it's a fear-based thing. And it's the rhetoric is incendiary. And most of the Trump supporters that I have talked to are so appreciative to have me come forward and not call them racist and not just start yelling at them about why they're wrong and why they're ruining the country. And when I do that, it's pretty tremendous, how easy it is to establish a connection.
Talking to Mark Duplass, he is a film director and producer and actor and seemingly somebody who is really rooted in common sense. We'll continue our conversation here in just a second.
Glenn Beck.
Mercury.
The Glenn Beck Program.
So, Mark, let me tell you a little bit about my experience, because we're on the same exact course. We can see people on both sides that are in pain, and quite honestly, we didn't take the time to really look or listen. I should speak for me. Just convinced that I'm right and I know exactly what you're thinking, and it really wasn't what people were thinking. And by my actions and my words, I took half the country, the left half, and just threw it away. And just assumed that, well, no, you'll get it because it's right. And stupid is that? And now I'm trying to reach out to the left and doing the same thing. I'm doing work with Operation Underground Railroad, which is freeing slaves and, you know, kids in sex slavery. And it's an amazing thing. And so far I've gotten Samantha Bee and Riaz Patel, and that's it. And and my audience is saying to me all the time, Glenn, that nobody on the left is going to do this. So this is a worthless cause. It's not going to happen. I imagine that you're feeling the same way. Are you getting anybody on the right to join you and say things like I have? Yeah, I get it. I was wrong. Sorry for the things that I did. I'm not changing my principles, but I certainly am apologizing for the things that I said that made people feel bad.
You know, the truth is, I think while you and I are coming from the same exact place, I really haven't asked that specific question of the right and or of anyone who honestly doesn't agree with my political principles. And I almost feel like I don't even need that step right now. I don't need the admittance of any wrong. I don't need the acknowledgement.
No, hang on just a second. I actually haven't. Yeah. I mean, I'm not really asking that. I would like to see that from the press only because it would show that they get it. But I don't need that from people. But what I am asking is, you know, you want to join me on some projects? Let's go work together. Let's, you know, let's put our audiences together and go do a service project or something. Is there anybody on the right that has responded to you in a positive way and said, I get it?
You know, so I went to speak with Steven Crowder, who was really, really great. You know, like I watched one of his shows, and quite frankly, I was terrified. He's big. He's extremely intelligent. He's good looking. I was like, he might beat me up. I don't know what's going to happen. He's loud. And he was very, very respectful. And I talked a lot about, you know, charitable causes on his program and as a place where, you know, I believe that we could, you know, cross the divide a little bit. And, you know, it was interesting because I think that, you know, I really respect him, but his motor to a certain degree is to engage in political debate. And I think that a lot of times when I reach across, our motors are set to debate and get, you know, and that is one thing that I'm trying to get good at disarming a bit so that I can just cut through on the bottom level a little bit more, which is, I mean, it's just kind of happening, quite frankly, naturally with you here, because I think that you and I happen to share, I don't know what it is.
I grew up in an alcoholic family, and I was the one that said, hey, everybody, let's get along, quite honestly.
Yeah. So, I was like, it sounds like you've gotten beat up a little bit in life. Sounds like you've been to therapy. You've been handed some sort of dose of humility. I've had that. I've dealt with, you know, depression and anxiety and artistic failure and all this stuff. And I feel weak in the world, and I am not certain that I am right anymore. And I want to share that with people because the not knowing creates intimacy, in my opinion. And I can be bombastic at times. Like, I do feel like I know what I'm doing in the film industry, and I can go to Sundance or South by Southwest and speak confidently about that. But when it comes to these bigger issues, I feel clueless.
I have to tell you, I would hope that we all do, because we all got us here, and none of it is working. Hang on just a second. Back with Mark Duplass in just a second.
Beck program. Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck program.
Mark Duplass is with us. He is a self-described elitist, out of touch Hollywood libtard. Which is pretty brutally honest. And welcome back to the program. A guy who said 3 months ago, I was tweeting things out, nasty things about Donald Trump and his supporters, and I realized, what the hell am I doing? Mark, can I take you to the movie Blue Jay for a second?
Please, yeah.
In that movie, which honestly is brilliant, unlike anything that I have seen, it perfectly captures an uncomfortable conversation between two people. It is perfect in its unrequited love. I mean, it's just a brilliant film. But in it, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but I'm going to, you find out that the woman, when she was a teenager, had an abortion of your baby, as you played the male role. When you're both teenagers and you said horrible things to each other and the whole relationship broke apart, and it's obvious you two still love each other 25 years later. That is that, as I watched that film, I watched it and I thought, that is a great pro-life movie, but it is also, you could say, it's a pro-choice movie, because she made the decision. And she has dealt with the consequences of that decision, but it was her decision to make, yada, yada. You could look at that movie and it was no straw man on either side. And so many, and I'm going to pull out my own side, so many Christian movies, I can say this about the left, but let me say it about the right. So many Christian movies make anyone who was playing the character of the woman in your movie look like the most evil witch imaginable. And so there's no honesty. And I really think that that's all that people are looking for is, I'm not a monster. You're not a monster. Can't we just come together and talk about this? I don't want to live this way anymore.
Look, I hope you're right. I hope there is a rising tide for this, and I'm willing to bet a bunch of money on it. And that's kind of what, you know, my mission is right now, is to create these sort of bipartisan, nonpartisan, whatever you want to call it, charitable giving campaigns. I spent a lot of time reaching out to a lot of my supporters on Twitter, a lot of Steven Crowder's, and even some of your fans when they found out I was coming here. And I said, look, what are the causes that we can all agree on? You know, and it was really fascinating because, again, a lot of conservatives like to give to their churches. A lot of liberals feel like, oh, I'm not so sure about that. They're skeptical of religion. I was like, okay, fine. Look, we're not going to argue here. We're going to look for the baseline stuff, you know? And, you know, really, education for kids, sick kids, highly efficient giving programs, clean water systems, you know, that was really good. And then I found out some blind spots of my own, which were great. I got my own education. A lot of conservatives said, why don't you guys ever talk about veterans? What is it? And I said, you know what? It's really weird. I do give a lot of charitable giving, and I don't often think about veterans. And I think it's tied to this defensiveness that the left has, that we spend too much, quote unquote, on the military, so that it often gets grouped into that. And you forget, like, oh, Jesus, these are the people who have served and we need to take care of them. And so I got a little education on that front. And then likewise, I was able to, you know, speak with some of my conservative fan bases who would say, you know what, America first, man, we got to take care of our people at home. What are you doing reaching out, you know, across these borders? Like, we're struggling here. And I would say, but yeah, for like 80 cents, we can install a clean water system in the third world. Like, and then we don't have to be there every day fixing it. It's done. Yeah. We led the horse to water and it's done. And they say, oh, well, that makes total sense. So I was like, well, this is great. I learned something. You learned something. Here we are.
I just hired two full-time psychiatrists for a shelter for kids that had been used in the sex slave trade. Two full-time doctors for $400 a month in Thailand.
Wow.
I mean come on. Yeah. I mean, geez.
So, you got it. So my challenge is, and I'm challenging the left mostly right now amongst my friends, is saying, guys, you were ready to pay a lot of taxes. You voted for a woman who was going to tax you, and you're going to save a lot of money next year. Congratulations. Now, you already signed that money away with your vote. So what I want you to do is take that, whatever your differential is, if you're in that top, you know, tax bracket and you're saving 8%, I want you to take a large chunk of that, and I want you to come with me and put some money down, and we're going to reach out and say, hey, everybody, come join us, you know, match us dollar for dollar. I did this once. I put in, you know, $10,000. All my fans came together. They matched me dollar for dollar. We made it into 20. I reached out to Google. I guilted them, and I said, you know, I'll take a picture with you, and you match us that other 20, and we'll turn it into 40 grand. You
That's
know?
Weird, because I did the same thing with Google, and I said, I won't take a picture with you.
Yeah.
And we
it worked.
It worked. It was great. Perfect. Yeah.
So I'm ready to stretch this idea out, and you know, I'm developing one for some foster care programs, which has been a really easy thing that everybody agrees on, you know, left, right, and, you know, trying. Look, I'm not above going to Wells Fargo and saying, hey, guys, you're looking pretty bad right now. If you want to put up some money, I'll shake your hand and take a picture with you if you give me a bunch to match. And,
oh, totally guilt him into it. Know, that's a great approach. It works.
Let's see what we can do. You know, I mean, I don't know. It's not going to change the world, but maybe there's some positivity in it. And you know, most importantly, I really want, while I have the ear of people right now who, you know, probably a lot of them didn't vote like I did and don't believe like I do, I just want you to know that my friends and I, when we gather for dinner, my elitist Hollywood libtard buddies, we're not all over here screaming how terrible you are. There are a few people on Twitter doing that, and yes, they do believe that way. But by the way, every day on Twitter, I'm getting people from the right screaming atrocities at me. Sure. I'm not going to allow that.
So do we.
Define all of you. And please do not allow that to define all of us. And know that we are interested. We are curious. We are trying to figure things out. And we're making that move. So
Mark, I have to tell you, I have been As the guys know, and many of the listeners know on this program, I have been searching for people like you for at least 2 years. And it's a thrill to talk to you because I know you guys exist. I just know you exist. And to have the balls to stand up and to do what you're doing is remarkable. Just remarkable. It's a real honor to talk to you.
Appreciate it. I feel the same way. And, you know, hopefully you and I can link up on some things and just.
So let's talk about that. What do we do?
You know, I'm starting a new campaign right now. It's in the early stages that, you know, is going to be targeted towards, you know, foster care. And my goal is to, a few times a year, just basically say, here I am, I'm putting down the money first, and then get some of my people around me who have enough extra cash. Thank God I am grossly overpaid for what I do. I'm not going to apologize for it, but I'm going to use some of that stuff because I don't need it, and create some of that capital. And again, just as you have said, I'm willing to be the first one to say I'm sorry. I'm willing to take the first step in. I'm looking for people who are willing to be first.
Okay, so let me do this.
Right. Come on, let's go.
I'll match you dollar for dollar on what you're doing. You want to put up another 10 grand or whatever, I'll match you on that. Will you, because feel free to say no, because I understand everybody's schedules. You willing to come to Africa with me? You're willing to get onto a plane and go and bring awareness to the slave trade that is currently happening in Africa with Operation Underground Railroad. It won't hold you to your answer now because I want you to do your research and see what it's all about. But are you willing to?
You know, normally people ask me out for like a milkshake first.
Right.
In Africa.
And then, yeah.
I don't care. I don't care how many kids you wind up saving.
If you want a milkshake, I can put one on the plane. But
by the way, I will 100% go to Africa with you because this is life. I mean, when Glenn Beck says, "Come on my show," and I'm going to bring you to Africa to do this in this time, and the fact that you and I on paper. Technically, I think should be screaming at each other right now.
Too.
If you look at our profile,
yeah,
and we're not, and right. We're agreeing. I feel like we owe it to ourselves to dive into this a little more, and you know, at the very least, scream at each other in Africa.
Oh so, my God, I would totally watch the movie Glenn and Mark go to Africa.
What are the odds that one of us is left in Africa?
Great.
Mark, it has truly been a privilege to talk to you. I think courage is contagious, and I so commend you for what you're doing. I know the risk you're taking. I know the hits you're going to take from both sides, believe me. And I'm just thrilled. And let's stay in touch, and you tell me, and please come back on, and you tell me what you're doing, and I'll write the check, and I'll be in touch and tell you where to meet the plane, and we'll go save some kids.
That sounds great. Milkshakes, Africa, some charitable giving. Mm-hmm. We start nice and easy, Glenn. That's just
start small. Africa today, Mars tomorrow.
A bit of advice, Mark. Fly separately.
Well, listen, I appreciate you guys being open and having me and let me pontificate a little bit here. And I will for sure be in touch. And, you know, it's very heartening to have a nice conversation like this. And I look forward to more.
Likewise. Thank you, Mark Duplass. Thank you so much.
He's awesome.
He is great.
Yeah.
That was great.
And you know what, Pat? Same guy that you saw in the movie, Blue Jay. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just honest. Mm-hmm. Just this honest, raw, real guy.
Yeah.
That movie.
I love how you hit him with a trip to Africa.
That's great.
Flying with you.
What do actors have to do all day?
Well, a lot, I would think.
They get up, walk around, and look at themselves in the mirror.
Take the dog for a walk.
Take the dog for a walk.
Look, as a guy who's been there, no matter what tragedy he sees, that flight is the real tragedy. The flight with Glenn Beck, where he's talking to you about sex slavery for 15 hours. Oh man, you're gonna wish you just written a chick.
What do you say? What are the odds I can what are the odds I can make him cry by the time? Not cry just to get off the plane, like please dear God, get me off this plane. What are the odds?
Heartbeat. Oh, I think you can. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Get him to cry.
I think you can get him to cry. I think that's what I want to see.
You might even break that before you hit the ocean.
You're still on the tarmac. When he realizes what a mistake he's made. It was,
what are the odds that he says to me, you know what, I'm taking a flight back, or I'm taking a giraffe back.
Yeah.
I'm going back on the back of a giraffe.
Glenn Beck program.
888-727 back.
Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck program.
That was a remarkable, just a remarkable conversation, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, really good. Really interesting.
One on which you could remark.
Yes,
that's a good point. It was historic as well, Pat, in that it happened in the past.
That's right.
Yeah, no, he was great.
That gives me hope.
We went from really good guy.
We went from last hour talking to a guy where we all went, we're doomed.
Yeah.
To this hour saying there's hope.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Maybe something can happen.
I don't know that.
I mean, you know what I really liked is he said, look, I just want you to know that there are those people. And that's a message, you know, that I should bring to their side more often. Yes, there are people that are, you know, saying, oh, Hollywood sucks, blah, 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 blah. But there's also a lot of people who aren't spending any time thinking about that. They're thinking about how can we get together? How can we be better Americans?
Well, it was interesting to see him kind of describe how he's in the middle of going through it.
Yes.
You know, we jump in the middle of that process. He didn't like decide this was the right thing to do 3 years ago and telling us how to do it. He was kind of learning as he went. I mean, he said himself 3 months ago, I'm on the internet doing things that I'm embarrassed about. And we've all had those moments where like you realize, geez, am I that guy? Am I doing that thing that I hate? And he was man enough to admit to himself, yeah, I kind of am. How do I change that?
You know, that's not easy. Boy, just being on this show, how much crap is he going to get?
Yes, he is.
He's going to get a ton of crap.
Yeah, he may not want anything to do with going to Africa with
you. Yeah, no, he may not. He may not. And I would understand it.
He may have to escape from Africa to Africa. Yeah, to Africa. Try to avoid this.
What? I didn't. I thought he was a lion. That's why I shot him. Oops, no, he wasn't a lion. I knew it was Glenn.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.